Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for your patience. You've joined Selling Liberal Education to Parents and Students. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. Should you require any additional assistance during the call, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference may be recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Mr. Scott Jasik. Sir, you may begin.
Hello, I'm Scott Jasik, editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome to today's audio conference on selling the value of liberal education to students and parents. The continuing economic downturn has made many colleges stress their professional programs and the path from higher education to employment. In turn, many families and many prospective students are asking a lot more questions about job prospects and direct links between what they study and what they hope to do after graduation. This leaves many educators worried about an erosion in an appreciation of the value of a liberal education and worries about what courses and programs students will take. Our guest today is Rick Davis, Associate Provost for Undergraduate Education at George Mason University, who has discussed these issues both on his campus and nationally. During the first half hour, Rick will lead us through the PowerPoint you all should have received. If any of you didn't receive it, please email me at info@insidehighered.com, and I'll get it to you right away. Shortly before the end of the presentation, we'll let you know how to ask questions, and then we'll have a Q&A. Rick, welcome.
Thank you, Scott, and hello, everybody across the country and across the world. I understand we have guests from Australia. Can't imagine what time it is there or even what day. Welcome, Canada, and even somebody from my old stomping grounds at Washington College in Chestertown. Hello over on the beautiful eastern shore of Maryland. I want to begin by, first of all, thanking you for your time today, thanking Scott for the invitation, and I'd like to say a word or two about George Mason so you know the sort of cultural context from which I'm operating. George Mason is a large state-supported university. We have a enrollment of about 32,000 students. We are, on some days, the largest university in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Some days we're not. It all depends on who's counting heads which day. Our friends down in Richmond at Virginia Commonwealth often take top honors. And we are, however, a large and growing state-supported institution with about 24,000 undergraduates and the balance in graduate programs. We have an increasingly aggressive research profile, and one of the strategic goals of the university over the last few years and on into the foreseeable future is to increase our research ranking, both in terms of sponsored research income and national and international profile. So as you all know, the system of faculty incentives, rewards, and rhetorical satisfaction that attends to that changes a little bit when an institution moves from a primarily teaching posture to a posture that more aggressively seeks research. And that has had some interesting byproducts in our pursuit of the ideals of the liberal arts that that I joined the provost's office to help advance. My own background, very quickly, is that I am an odd fellow in the paradise of academic higher administration. I come out of the theater department and am an active director of theater and opera and a translator and sometime critic, but was the beneficiary of a strong liberal arts education in my undergraduate days and have been practicing the theatrical profession known as dramaturgy, which is I like to think of as the extension of liberal arts into the professional arts world. So I have a very, very passionate and deeply convicted belief in the value of the liberal arts and joined the provost office here in order to try to help shape the conversation about that vital issue at a place and in a time where I felt that some of those values were not exactly under attack, that would be too aggressive, but were threatened by other institutional priorities, and as Scott said in his intro, by the times we live in. So with that as background, I want to walk through the genesis of the presentation that I have given for the last 2 years to hundreds and hundreds of, actually thousands now, of students and their parents. Started a tradition, which I hope continues, a couple of years ago, to speak to each incoming orientation group. We enroll about 2,500 first-time, full-time freshmen every year, and I think I reached the vast majority of them and their parents over the course of 10 orientation sessions. These happen during June and July. They happen in a large concert hall and in a large meeting room. They happen at a time when students are being bombarded with all kinds of practical and logistical and registration-oriented information and a whole bunch of school spirit, which is great, but they were not being offered too much to think about on the academic front. And so my colleagues and I thought it might be a good idea to try to reach students and their parents in tandem with some potentially inspiring but at least informative words about the kind of education that we were about to try to involve them in and to try to get them ready for the journey that was to come. That's part one. Part two of that genesis was that I felt very strongly that general education, which is a program that I also superintend here at the university, the general education program, the classic distribution requirements, all of that fairly traditional 11 areas of study and so on, which we'll talk about more in a moment, I felt that, I knew from many, many conversations and feedback from students and parents, that the general education requirements were increasingly being seen as an obstacle. They were increasingly being seen as something that needed to be gotten through and not something that had value in and of themselves, either idealistically or pragmatically. So I thought we ought to try to tackle that head on. And that was the genesis of the slide presentation, which I will walk you through in a moment. So I want you to imagine, come with me to the imaginary setting of a concert hall, large auditorium. The parents are dealt with first. We keep them in two separate groups, and that way I can tell them slightly different stories and see if they catch me. and sometimes they do. But the setting is about 300 or 400 parents and or guardians, other relatives. They've just gone through about an hour of discussion of all kinds of very practical logistical issues, and I come on the stage and talk to them about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that's our first slide. And if you're with me on that first page, either in print or on the screen, you'll see it's called Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, or Why Go to College. And I start with the Jeffersonian quotation and the somewhat provocative subtitle, both to place the ensuing conversation in terms that are familiar to most of the audience, of course, but that they might not have thought of in specifically educational terms. My take on liberal education, and again, there's not much original here except maybe the framing of it, my take on liberal education is that it organizes itself rather neatly into the three baskets of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it's fun to note, especially from the George Mason perspective, that although Thomas Jefferson wrote these exact words, his friend and colleague and our namesake, George Mason, was one of the authors of some of the rhetoric that preceded this exact formulation. And I can usually get a chuckle out of the audience by claiming that George Mason actually wrote the phrase. And although we love our friends down at the University of Virginia, Mr. Jefferson's University, we also think pretty well of George Mason's, the man's contribution to that. Turning the page to the next slide titled General Education, an Obstacle Course or a Ladder to Success, and I apologize for these cheesy Microsoft graphics there, but they do sort of get the idea that many students and many parents think of Gen Ed as the thing you have to get through before you can do the real work for which you came to college, and that is the professional vocational preparation that your major offers you. And we like to try to reframe that discussion in the following way, that in fact, what general education does is provide you the skills, the tools, and most importantly, the habits of mind that will help you succeed not only in your eventual major, but in your life beyond college. We state that rhetorically initially, and then we try to provide some evidence for it in the next couple of slides. The next slide, titled Liberal Education, allows me to do just a little bit of a historical beat, and depending on my read of the audience, I'll go into the trivium and the quadrivium, and we'll go all the way back to classical antiquity in the Middle Ages, or I'll kind of gloss over it if I feel some restlessness in the crowd. I don't sense anyway, by the way, any restlessness in this crowd. You've been very attentive so far. I don't hear any rustling of papers, which is terrific. But the framing is that liberal education, of course, goes back to classical antiquity, but it's the most modern of all ways of organizing study because it prepares one for a changing world. That has, in a way, always been its premise, but never more relevantly than in today's world, because today's world, we know from various sociological and demographic studies, offers or requires, really, that students who are graduating from college now or in the foreseeable future probably will have to navigate 5, 6, 7, as many as 10 different career paths. And the second laugh line for the parents in this presentation is that it's really daunting to think about majoring in 7 or 10 things or getting 10 bachelor's degrees, although we certainly would love to have the tuition money that that would represent. That gets their attention and prepares them for the idea that, in fact, you're going to major in 1 or 2 things, you're going to be deeply prepared for those things, but you're not necessarily going to be specifically vocationally trained for everything that life might throw at you. So what's the alternative to that? The alternative to that is the flexibility, the habit of mind, the ability to think critically, work collaboratively and creatively in ways that prepare us for just about anything. Turning the page now to the slide marked life, and here we return to the Jeffersonian triad, as I like to call it, of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You might expect an idealistic quotation here about life from a philosopher or something, but I give them instead David Kearns from the Xerox Corporation, former CEO of Xerox, because over and over in the literature about liberal education, some of which has been collected very handily by the American Association of Colleges and Universities through their Project LEAP, and on our last slide you'll see some resources from Project LEAP, some very, very good web links that AACNU has put together and from which some of this is drawn. So I give them David Kearns, who says, the only education that prepares us for change is a liberal education. In periods of change, narrow specialization condemns us to inflexibility, precisely what we do not need, and so on. That is a persuasive argument from the pragmatic point of view, because it's someone obviously operating from a high-tech and at the time highly successful corporate perspective who recognizes the value of liberal education. And again, AACNU has collected mounds of this data about how the business world values the things that liberal education represents, even if they don't always call it liberal education. Turning now to the slide marked liberty. And here I can't resist bringing Jefferson back into the conversation because Jefferson, of course, is pretty good on the subject of liberty. He had a lot to say about it. And this quotation, which I'm going to read all of it to you because I love hearing these words, and it actually, from time to time, gives me a bit of a chill on the back of my neck when I get to the second part. I encourage the audience to look at this quotation in two parts. The first part, before the ellipsis, has to do with the ideals of liberal education as it relates to citizenship, which I think is a high calling in today's world. And the second part relates to the mission of the contemporary public university, or indeed any university that wants to make access to higher education one of its priorities. And I think that describes pretty much all of us these days. So Jefferson in 1779 says, "Those persons whom nature has endowed with genius and virtue should be rendered by liberal education worthy to receive and able to guard the sacred deposit of the rights and liberties of their fellow citizens. And here's part two, they should be called to that charge without regard to wealth, birth, or other accidental condition or circumstance." Now that phrase, especially that second part, really makes me newly inspired every time I read it or see it about the business that we're all in, that we are in the business of bringing the values of liberal education to those whom nature has endowed with genius and virtue. And by the way, I can always get a laugh from the students on this slide after I read it by saying, those people who are endowed with genius and virtue, that's you guys. And they recognize themselves in the quotation. But it truly is an inspiring phrase about liberty. At this point, I also sometimes take a moment to defuse the word liberal from liberal education. I know that we all have to confront this from time to time, but especially living 15 miles from Washington, D.C., as we do, there is a highly sometimes politicized atmosphere around life here just outside the Beltway and certainly inside the Beltway. And believe it or not, some people still mistakenly associate liberal education with political liberalism. They share an etymological root, as we know, but not necessarily a one that has roots in public policy or anything beyond that. And so I give them the Latin liber, talk about free, talk about freedom, talk about what a liberal education frees us to do. And we say that it frees you to do many, it frees you from, first of all, it frees you from many negative things. It frees you from ignorance. It frees you from intolerance. It frees you from the paralysis of not knowing how to confront new situations. And it frees you to do a lot of quite wonderful things. It frees you to be tolerant. It frees you to collaborate. It frees you to analyze situations on your own, using your own critical resources, rather than depending entirely on the opinions and the data of others. So framing liberal education as an education that frees rather than education that tends to promote political liberalism is a great comfort, and it just happens to be true. I say it's a comfort to some members of every audience that we probably talk to. Turning the page now to the pursuit of happiness, and this in this presentation is also a bit of a reliable chuckle, and again, I hear the chorus out there. The pursuit of happiness, when I talk to the parents, I'll sometimes lean very close to the microphone to see if I can do that with the telephone here, and I'll say, now I know that some of you are worried that your students might actually be coming to college expressly for this purpose, that they might actually pursue happiness, and they might actually find it, and they might find it too often and in ways that you're not comfortable with. And by that time, you usually have them. But of course, we want to reframe, as we do with all of these terms, we want to reframe the pursuit of happiness in somewhat more idealistic and lofty terms. We talk about the pursuit of happiness as being sometimes an appreciation for, as Matthew Arnold says, the best that has been thought and said. We talk about the pursuit of happiness as the value that education brings because it allows you to encounter new ideas without the insecurity that ignorance brings. And then I have these four, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. But then we have these four wonderful quotations. We have Santayana, of course. Knowledge of what is possible is the beginning of happiness. And that is a liberating idea in itself, that knowledge of what is possible, not necessarily knowledge of what is, but knowledge of what is possible, and more importantly, that things are possible, that progress is possible. And then Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a wonderful Buddhist philosopher and teacher, the amount of happiness that you have depends on the amount of freedom you have in your heart. A beautiful idea, and again linked to the idea of personal freedom, that idea of liberal freedom, liberal liberation, really. And then Virginia Woolf, the man who is aware of himself, and of course she's operating from an earlier rhetorical posture where we have a gender-neutral pronoun here. The man who is aware of himself is henceforward independent, and he's never bored, and life is only too short, and he is steeped through and through with a profound yet temperate happiness. So self-awareness is one of the byproducts of liberal education, I would claim, along with Virginia Woolf, and the idea that that creates happiness and actually makes the days feel too short because you want to live more fully, I think, is an important idea. And then, lest we stay too high into the clouds, we bring back Andrew Carnegie. If you want to be happy, set a goal that commands your thoughts, liberates your energies, there's that word again, and inspires your hopes. And there's another little silly story that I sometimes tell in this regard because it makes it personal and it makes it concrete. And I talk about how I used to be radically bored with the idea of soccer. I used to think, I would occasionally tune in and I used to think, why is this game played in front of tens of thousands of people when there are never any points scored, as I used to call them? There's people run up and down the field, they never score, there's this huge net, and there are all these people running around kicking this ball, but nobody ever scores, and then if they do, there's a huge celebration that just stops everything, every time, and then the referees, if that's what they're called, seem to arbitrarily add time to the game just for fun, and they have these cards, and who knows what that means. And I'm used to 9 innings, I'm used to 4 quarters, I'm used to 60 minutes, I'm used to sports that have sort of an organized structure, and this sport doesn't seem to. So all of which by way of saying, last couple years, I have started to get interested in this fabulous sport because teams that I have cared about have advanced, and I have started to follow it, and I've started to listen to the color commentators in all their ebullience, and I've started to analyze the game along with them. In other words, I've been educated by teachers and experience, and suddenly Sometime during last year's World Cup, and much more forcefully this year, suddenly I stopped being bored and started being riveted. Simply because I knew the rules, and I knew what was going on, and I understood the patterns, and I could understand that coaches actually have meaningful plays to put in, and so on. Now, take a moment when you're talking with students or parents about this and say, now replace soccer with Beethoven, replace soccer with physics, replace soccer with Shakespeare, whatever it might be, and you can easily see, it's a pretty rudimentary analogy, but it really seems to work. You can easily see how a little knowledge, a little experience, a little exposure, even a little participation can turn what was boring and mysterious and meaningless into something quite riveting. So that's sort of the philosophical setup for the idea that liberal education has personal and pragmatic value, and just a little bit of evidence on each point. Then, and I don't want to spend too much time on these next couple of slides, but then I walk the students and their parents through the structure of the general education program here at George Mason, because the one thing that our own assessment data have shown is that both faculty members, to a diminishing degree, but certainly students, find that the structure of the gen ed program appears arbitrary. It seems like a bunch of requirements that someone put in place years ago that are designed to basically fill the time before the major kicks in. I get feedback every year from a couple of colleagues who teach 400-level, what we call synthesis courses, and there are some really interesting and somewhat disturbing reflections about students' perceptions of the general education program and its, as they perceive it, lack of coherence. So one of our missions is to articulate the structure at several junctures throughout the student's general education career, at the beginning and then during the introductory level courses and then finally at the end during the synthesis course, so that they can understand that there is in fact a design in place. There is in fact an architecture that some intelligent people have crafted, and the intentionality of that helps students understand that even though what they're experiencing at the moment may not seem to be directly applicable to their current goals, that with enough patience and with enough understanding of the design, they can make a relevant connection to it at some future point. So we walk through, in very much an outline form, what I call the triple pillars of Gen Ed. The first one is quite obvious, the foundation, writing, speaking, counting, and computing for short, and we all see what those areas are. We all have our own versions of that, I'm sure. Turning to the second slide, the triple pillars, slide two, this is the core, and again, it's fairly traditional. I think we have a fairly representative set of distribution requirements, arts, literature, world history, Western Civ, natural science, social behavioral, and global understanding, which is a very robust feature of George Mason life. We have a very international campus with 150 countries represented or so, 135, I guess, and a very strong international portfolio of activities. And then finally, and I think, Scott, you're about to...
Yes. Actually, if I can just interrupt for a minute to have our operator explain how people can ask questions when we're done. Operator?
Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, please press the pound key. Again, to ask a question at this time, press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
Also, if you would like to ask questions but you do not want your institution identified, you may email them to me at info@insidehighered.com, and I'll read the question but not identify the institution. Again, that's info@insidehighered.com. Now back to you, Rick, to wrap up.
Okay, thanks. So moving to the third pillar, which we call putting it together, we have a requirement here that is, I'm sure, not unique. I know it's not unique, but is perhaps slightly unusual, and that is we have a synthesis course, a gen ed course, which is, by requirement, is an upper-level course. Many of them are 300-level. A great number of them are 400-level courses. And the idea for the synthesis course, which is offered in a variety of disciplines, there are about 40 different departments that offer synthesis courses, that critical thinking is the number one goal for synthesis course, and the learning outcomes are written in such a way that critical thinking is the most important element. They also require students to demonstrate written and oral expression, which are, if you remember, foundation requirements. They're now required to demonstrate those things at an advanced level. And the synthesis course must contain an interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary approach to problem solving. So these courses have developed across the curriculum in very, very interesting ways, and it's a way of saying the values of general and liberal education that we try to establish in the first and second year maintain their vitality all the way through the curriculum and, in fact, have a required demonstrative output towards the end of the curriculum. And these are courses that, frankly, were challenging to develop a few years ago when the requirement was instantiated, but they have proven to be some of the more interesting courses, I think, at the university. And we've just concluded our colleagues in the Office of Institutional Assessment a course portfolio assessment process on these courses, and they have been really quite extraordinarily interesting to look at, both the alignment of the course materials with the learning outcomes around critical thinking and interdisciplinarity, and the samples of student work that we saw as part of the portfolio process were really, I think, quite encouraging and quite confirming that something positive was happening, is happening, with the idea of liberal education and general education. So to sum up this part of the plan or of the program, this little approach to selling, as Scott called it in the title, selling the value of liberal education, it's going to be difficult, I think, to quantify the value of this approach, but I have been getting increasing amounts of feedback by email, certainly, and the most fun kind of feedback is the parent or the occasional student who will stop me on the plaza or the quad on the second day of orientation, and they'll recognize my yellow Mason baseball cap, and they'll say, "You were the guy who talked to us yesterday, weren't you? And I really want to thank you for the way you framed the idea of college education. I had a parent tell me just recently, now I understand why I went to college. Now I understand what it was all about." And I thought that was a nice way to find some validation in this admittedly amorphous effort to instill the values of liberal education at the front door of the university. And then, as I say, we try to have faculty members talk about these things throughout the Gen Ed curriculum and really return to them with great focus and purpose in the synthesis course. My fantasy is that over time, over the next few years or over the next generation or two of students, this way of thinking and, this, more importantly, this way of articulating and communicating the value of the liberal arts at this multidisciplinary, research-oriented, state-supported university will start to effect a culture shift to where the liberal arts will no longer be a questionable value. They will have demonstrated their both philosophical vitality, their pragmatic utility, and their personal satisfaction. And that concludes my formal remarks, and I eagerly await your questions.
Well, I'm going to start by exercising the moderator's prerogative and ask the question that I hear colleges increasingly stumped by, which is a parent saying, "Well, that all sounds well and good, but my barista at Starbucks this morning was a recent college grad. How do I know that's not going to be the outcome for my kid?"
Well, I've heard that question, or some variation of it. And actually, there are a number of ways of handling that. The one that is a little flippant, and so I don't recommend it, but it sort of depends on the context, is to say, and I'll try to state it in a way that's not flippant, even though there's a flippancy latent in the answer. Personal satisfaction in life is only partly determined by one's vocation. And one's vocation is not one's destiny. There is, as I said earlier, at least in the sort of the traditional formulation of the American economy, there is a fair amount of mobility. And I would say even in challenging times, there might even be more mobility because careers end or careers are transformed by new technologies or new political and economic stringencies. And so the common value that takes you across vocations is your personal store of knowledge, wisdom, insight, and personal resource. So the barista might be earning a decent living, but if that barista, compare a liberally educated barista to, let's say, a non-liberally educated barista, and maybe think about the ability of the former to move up the chain into management, perhaps, using skills of oral and written communication or quantitative reasoning or information technology. Think about, and here's the part I sort of said was flippant, but I really kind of mean it more romantically. If you have a little bit of Mozart in your head, or a little bit of Shakespeare available to you, or a little bit of quantum physics that you can retreat to, you can make almost any job interesting. And I sometimes tell a story on myself, and it's a true story, that if a faculty meeting ever gets boring, and I don't know if you've ever had that experience, I know every now and then it happens, or say a faculty senate meeting or something, it gives me great pleasure as a theater worker to be able to literally turn on what I call a mental iPod without having a physical one, and just play a little bit of The Marriage of Figaro or a little bit of King Lear to myself. And the value of a liberal education is demonstrated over plus in moments like that. So that's the flippant part. There are other ways of answering that question too, but the pragmatic way is to say most careers are temporary, and the more skills you have, the more flexibility you have, the more likely you are to be able to take on the next challenge that presents itself after the barista life comes to a conclusion.
Okay, thank you for that. And operator, could we have our first question in the queue, please?
Yes, sir. Our first question comes from Fairfield University. Your line is open.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, please go ahead.
Something that I've always wondered about is as schools get larger, whether they can maintain their liberal education in the same way. You describe a general education scheme, and a school of your size, is that not modified or even watered down in the various professional schools where undergraduates may be majoring?
That's an excellent question, and we try very, very hard here as we evolve not to water it down in any meaningful way. There are a couple of strains that pull against that, as I'm sure you're aware. One of them is accreditation requirements in various fields. Engineering is one, nursing is another, business is a third. Those three spring to mind. But we have been able to make, I guess, what might be called reasonable accommodations with each of those areas, such that we have crafted optional ways to fulfill on the margins 3 to 6 credits of the overall general education requirement in ways that satisfy the field-specific accreditors and maintain certainly the spirit and 95% of the letter of the general education program. There is another way in which size is a challenge, of course, and that is in sheer volume of students that need to be served by the Gen Ed program, and we have attempted to work with schools and departments to give them quite a bit of flexibility in certain areas and then be quite specific in others. I'll give you an example. The English composition course, which operates here on basically 3 levels, at the 100 level, the 300 level, and then in a writing intensive course that's in the disciplines. Each of those levels has a class size limit that is fairly restrictive. I think the 101 is 22 students or something like that. The 302 is just slightly larger, the 300 level. And then the writing intensive course is 35 students, so that the faculty member has time to really work with writing, revising, and iterative process. Whereas we make no such claims to restrict class size on, say, a Psych 100 lecture course. We're also moving toward hybrid and distance delivery modes for some of the courses that have extremely high demand and are essentially knowledge transfer type of courses, in the hope that we can create more interactive teaching strategies. This is a struggle that I think many of our institutions are facing at the moment. Are there ways to activate the large lecture class experience that haven't been tried yet or that are evolving? And I really hope we can make some progress in that regard as well.
Thank you. Operator, could we have our next question in the queue, please? Operator?
I'm sorry, our next question comes from the University of Minnesota. Your line is open. The University of Minnesota, your line is open. Please make sure your line isn't muted.
Yes, Rick, we appreciate your presentation. It's been very helpful, and I think with important philosophical underpinnings of this. As you said, however, it's a little amorphous. And back to the initial question is, what's the so what when parents are asking us why liberal education versus another field, and why here versus another place? And we talk often about the elevator speech. We often have very brief periods of time to be able to make our point. So if you're in an elevator with us right now and you have about 30 seconds to convince a parent why liberal arts, and especially in the era of careers and all that, what would you say?
Great question. I'm terrible at elevator speeches, but I've been able to craft a little one out of a piece of the remarks that I shared with you earlier. The one that really tells on the pragmatically minded person is this notion of multiple careers. This is a very, very telling point, and happily it's backed up by good data. If you go to the last page, the pursuit of information, you'll find resources there that will validate this. The idea that your vocational preparation really is only good for your first job, and in some fast-changing fields, not even that. We've heard from several CEOs in the high-tech industries that surround us here in Northern Virginia that they would rather have a student who can read well, write well, speak well, and collaborate well with creativity and insight, because they are going to be the ones who are going to teach them the software. They are going to be the ones who are going to teach them what the latest DoD contract requires. So they don't want us to do the vocational work. They want us to do the formation of character work. They want us to do the critical thinking work. I realize I've exceeded the elevator time already. We're on the seventh floor. But I'll tell you that if you can distill that message, the idea of 5 to 7 careers, and that you can't prepare for every single one of them, what you have to do is learn how to learn. That seems to work with even the most hard-bitten vocational thinkers.
Well, thank you. We'll consider that the Empire State Building elevator speech. And, operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Yes, sir. Our next question comes from Stetson University. Your line is open.
Yes, we're interested in what sort of measurement you have of seniors and outcomes and their liberal education. What do your seniors say about their experience in general education? What do they hear from employers? And is there a difference between the CEO who loves liberal arts and the employment officer who wants people with lots of technical skills for a particular position? And finally, do your career placement surveys offer anything to support what we hope is true about liberal education?
I'm going to speak more about the things I really know about, which is the first part of your question. And the second part, I'm probably going to have to punt a little bit. We do have very, very good and recent assessment data on all of the almost all of the 11 areas. I think we have 8 of the 11 areas of our Gen Ed program have been recently assessed through our course portfolio process, which includes faculty reflection and student survey feedback, as well as direct analysis of student work samples, as well as analysis by teams of faculty reviewers of the alignment of student learning outcomes that are stipulated by the program versus the course design and assignment design of each course that's under review. So we feel we have a pretty good direct measure of how the courses are performing in the field, and the results have been relatively encouraging. I will tell you that the biggest negative finding that we've had so far over about a 3-year assessment cycle now is a lack of intentionality, a lack of framing the course as a part of a liberal or general education. And we hear this both from the faculty reviewers who sometimes don't see it in the syllabus or in any of the materials that the instructor provides. We hear it resoundingly from the students in survey data and other responses where they they don't necessarily understand how this course relates to any other course, or how this one particular course relates to the arc of their general education. So this is, for me, sort of confirming suspicions, but also represents a wonderful target of opportunity, because to the extent that we can increase intentionality, to the extent that we can make the program more articulate, I think when we come to the next round of assessment, which is we're already starting to circle back to some of the first areas that we looked at, I believe and hope that we will see a change. And with that, I'll finesse the career service question, because I actually don't have current feedback from them. I do want to, however, highlight one of your other points, and I wish I knew the answer to this, and maybe someone else on the call does. The apparent disconnect that you articulated between the CEO who is the advocate for liberal education and the person that often answers the survey from AACNU or whoever else might be asking the question, and the recruiter in the field who may or may not have those same values. And I wish that we could somehow create a grand workshop for CEOs and HR departments and get them all together speaking the same language, because that would be tremendously useful to all of us.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Yes, sir. Our next question comes from the line of Maria Cuso. Your line is open.
We're here at the University of Wisconsin-Superior, and my question is, this presentation was very helpful in explaining the curricular or the academic side of student learning, but how do you integrate and talk with parents and students about the co-curricular, which together creates the holistic learning experience for the student?
That's a fantastic question, and the local answer to that is that we have, as part of all of these efforts of the summer orientation, but then also throughout the year, we have a very active partnership between the academic units and the Division of University Life, which here is a very robust program with a dedicated vice president and so on, and a large staff, including, and this is kind of an interesting development for me anyway, they have, the University Life folks here have their own academic director, they have their own assessment team, and they are actually working with high intentionality on the measuring the learning outcomes of co-curricular activities such as living learning communities, residential life programs, service learning programs. So there's a real, at this institution anyway, there's a real symbiosis between the academic program and the University Life efforts that work alongside. Now, there are certain disconnects that we haven't yet been able to figure out. We haven't yet been able to figure out a way, for example, of capturing international education. We have a gen ed category, as I outlined, called Global Understanding. There's a lot of ways here at this university, and I think all of our institutions, of achieving global understanding outside of the classroom, whether it's study abroad, whether it's cultural interactions with international students, whether it's work in the community. There's all kinds of ways of achieving really profound global understanding, perhaps more than you could get in a semester class. We have here something called a Global Proficiency Certificate, which is administered by this Division of University Life. It has an academic component, but it doesn't necessarily integrate with the general education program itself, and I wish that it did. All of which, by way of saying, there's sort of good news, bad news here in this regard. University Life is very academically focused here, very collaborative, but there's still challenges when it comes down to specific subject areas. Another one, just to very briefly on this question, because it's so fascinating, the other area that I think is ripe for further investigation in terms of co-curricular and curricular is my home area of the arts, because as we all know, the arts are often best studied experientially, and we haven't figured out, despite all of our artistic and academic alliances, we haven't figured out how to do that in a systematic way yet either. So much remains to be done, but the personnel are in place and the spirit is in place to do some work there.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Yes, sir. And that question comes from East Carolina University. Your line is open.
Hello, Rick. Thanks for answering our questions here about liberal arts. I just have a quick question because I'm a career counselor and I deal mainly working with liberal arts students. To go back to your original thought about linking education to employment, could you talk a little bit about some of the concrete skills that liberal arts students gain that make them marketable in a variety of careers?
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that I work with our own career folks on periodically, and they're very good about including folks from the academic units and the provost's office in their conversations. The number one thing that I think we sell, if you will, for the liberally educated student is the ability to think on your feet, the ability to respond quickly, creatively, with insight and patience to new challenges, to issues of collaborative tension, the ability to write a clear memorandum or a clear briefing document or a clear technical paper. These are things that employers tell us that they want, they respect, they need, and they really prize when students present these kind of materials. So I encourage students always to make sure that they are thinking about their classwork in terms of a potential portfolio, in terms of things that they can actually show an employer. Yes, I look at this, I wrote this, look, I drafted this, look, I worked in a team that created this case study. These are things that are directly relevant to the workplace and that a good liberal arts program, they are the byproducts in terms of work products of a good liberal arts education. So encouraging students to save things, e-portfolios, of course, are on the rise nationwide, but even a good old-fashioned glossy binder can capture a lot of it. Instructors should be encouraged to create assignments that generate portfolio quality material, and they should be encouraged to give the kind of feedback for revision that gets the material to a professional level, so that by the time the student graduates, he or she has an abundance of material that can be persuasive to any number of kinds of employers. The core values, as we all know, of the liberal arts are critical thinking and communication skills, and each one of those could be the subject of another seminar, but I think we all probably share that value. So from my point of view, the trick is to proselytize on the value of those values, but then make sure on the back end that we are creating the academic conditions where those things can be encouraged, demonstrated, reviewed, and then finally presented.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Yes, sir. Our next question comes from Southern Illinois. Your line is open.
Rick, it's good to listen to you today. My question is, what do you do at your institution to help students make the transition to the first job, so that they don't end up floundering for the first 3 to 5 years after they graduate?
There's a lot of work that is done on two fronts. And I'm sure, again, this is common to a lot of our institutions. The first thing is that we have a very active internship program. I mean, it's not a program. It's a number of programs across the disciplines. Recently, 2 to 3 years ago, we kind of had an internship summit where we got academic leadership and career services leadership and legal counsel and a whole bunch of other folks together to look at crafting a common internship contract or letter of agreement, memorandum of understanding, so that the internship site and the academic unit and the student would all have a common understanding of goals, learning goals, and review procedures and some of the other legal niceties. We were able to get the document down from 8 pages to 2, which was a great triumph, I thought. So on that end, obviously experiential learning is a great way to try the workplace out to see if it's for you and you're for it, and if not, to find a different workplace, and also to create a marketable resume. And the other thing is the Career Center itself, and again, in collaboration with academic units, but they really take the lead on this, they do extensive mock interviewing and preparation for the transition into the workforce, as you describe it. Once the student's in the workplace, I don't know exactly if I have a good answer for that. I tell my own students, and I think this is probably eccentric, but I tell my own students that I offer them a permanent warranty on their education, and if they're ever having a problem in their workplace, that they should call me for retraining. I say it with a smile and with a laugh, but in fact, I've had a lot of students take me up on that over the years. I wouldn't necessarily want to make that university policy, however.
Thank you. I want to ask a question that came in via email from a listener who's having particular issues with this with male students. Do you have any suggestions about reaching male students with this message? And do you notice, and this is now me asking this part, are there other subsets of students that you frame your arguments in different ways for?
That's a very interesting question. I I don't know that I have a specific answer to the gender portion of it, except I will tell you, and this is silly, but I will tell you that once I stumbled on the soccer analogy, I really found that did resonate with a certain subset of the male student population. Again, I don't want to generalize that too much or go too far into it, but speaking pragmatically, that is the case. The one area where I do think we have to be sensitive, careful, not diluting at all the message, but just being aware is with the international student population who may or may not come to our universities with the same orientation to the very idea of a liberal education and certainly the very idea of mobility in the workforce and so on. Try to be very respectful of cultural norms from the various places that our students come from. Be, you know, certainly asserting the values that, that we hold dear, but in a way that, that allows for a bit of frank skepticism at times, and also allows for a constructive engagement with those views. And there's a way to frame this message that is inclusive, and there are, I think, ways that, that we all occasionally stumble into that, that might not be so inclusive. And I always try to err on the side of inclusivity when it comes to people that are approaching these institutions that we sort of hold in sacred trust, coming at them from different points of view where that might not be part of the cultural tradition.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Yes, sir. The next question comes from the line of Jolene Little. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. This is actually Franklin Pierce University, and thanks, Rick, for your presentation, your thoughts. We've actually been selling general education for quite a number of years. We have had an integrated core curriculum that has been orchestrated around a theme, and we've been making that pitch. It's been a conspicuous part of how the university has sort of presented itself to parents and students. It turned out that the sell is a little harder actually at home in the classroom and with our faculty. We've recently done a thorough redesign of our approach, and following the LEAP initiative, we've devised an outcomes-based approach to general and liberal education that's consciously holistic, that sees the majors in general education in partnership to ensure student achievement of these goals. And we're now considering, I think, a marketing strategy that would, instead of focusing on general education, would focus on this holistic education, a Franklin Pierce education, sort of trying to frame it in that way. Now, that probably, you know, just defers the question of, well, why are courses that are not in my major a part of the Franklin Pierce education? And so we would at some point be back to, you know, defending a general education. But do you have any thoughts on that kind of marketing approach?
First of all, I have an extremely positive reaction to the notion of the holistic liberal education that, that ties together the general education and the major. I think the Project LEAP outcomes are wonderful, and we are, I would say, working our way toward that out of specific articulated learning outcomes for each gen ed category, and then some meta outcomes, if you will, that essentially take that forward into the majors and indeed represent the entire experience of a college career. And this is a work in progress, but I think it's a wonderful initiative, and it really begins to erode the boundaries between the general education and the rest of the education. I think that's really the signal insight of the Project LEAP materials, and I'm glad to hear that that's working. I do think your point is correct, though, that eventually people are going to start asking those questions again, and then one just has to recur to these core values and say that the scope of human knowledge is vast, and that over the course of a lifetime, nothing is wasted. And if we can make that point, if we can live that point, if we can get faculty members to be expressive and articulate about that point, and really model the behavior and habits of mind and the dispositions of a liberally educated person, I think we'll win that battle in the long run.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Actually, sir, there appear to be no further questions.
Oh, okay. I've got another question from via email. We are struggling with students participating in our career development workshops as well as our academic success workshops. We have very low or no turnout for these events. What recommendations do you have to attract students to these important workshops?
Three color posters? I don't know. That's an excellent question. I'll say this is not a good answer. This is just a report from the field. We used to have the same problem going back 5 to 8 years, and something happened in the culture at Mason, and I do not know what it is. Perhaps it was the changing rhetorical posture. Perhaps it was the increasing SAT profile of the incoming students or GPA profile, whatever it is. Perhaps it's just the relative humidity, but we have crossed that border. We used to have very low turnout at those kinds of workshops, and now they tend to fill. So I guess my only pragmatic advice is to keep at it and don't lose heart, because those are important activities. And I find that if you we used to worry when we scheduled something like that, and now we worry about having a room that's big enough. So there's hope at the end of that path.
Well, on that encouraging note, that's all the time that we have today for questions. To our listeners, you'll receive an evaluation about today's presentation that will also give you the ability to make suggestions for future audio conferences. I'd like to thank our audience for your thoughtful questions, and thank you to Rick for sharing your presentation and your great perspective. To everybody, have a good day.